I wasn't intending to teach this evening. The films that I was screening turned out to be disappointing and not worth writing an essay about, let alone showing to you and wasting your time. So I felt that at least deep meditation would be the best use of our time, given the circumstances that we are in within the dream field. And I think probably most of you still read the news or watch whatever video news is of your ideological favor. But it's pretty clear that the conflict zones in the world are heating up, and the threat of an ultimate global thermonuclear war is now out there and being spoken directly about by governments, as well as hysterical commentators who are finally getting the picture that the decision has already been made, and the various theaters of war in the different regions of the world are all accelerating toward the point of no return. And so for yogis, we also need to reach a point of no return, but it must be no return to the ego, no return to the illusion, no return to the wheel of life and death, no return to subjection to the bondage of the dark force of the other that keeps the ego consciousness in a stunted level of internal development and self-realization. So the ancient sages have all known that we would reach this point, the omega point, to use a term by a modern scientific philosopher, Teilhard de Chardin. But it's not really the omega in the sense that it's the end of the real. It's only the end of the ignorance of the ego. So that with the return of knowledge, of truth, comes the return of the capacity to dream a world of beauty and goodness and harmony and freedom. And we are now in this state when all of that is lost. So the ancient model of the world cycle, which is also, by the way, the symbol of the swastika, is that in which the world cycle is divided into four seasons, just as the yearly cycle, and at a more fractal level, the daily cycle. And in the Golden Age or Satyuga, the energy is all that of emanation and creation. And then it becomes that of expansion and sustenance in the Silver Age. And then the power of creation, it can no longer be sustained at a certain point, and it is lost. And the Copper Age, I would say, can be characterized by attempted recovery of what was lost, which is that power of creative intelligence to sustain the world. And then in the final phase, self and other destruction. In the Copper Age, there is still a battle. It's called Dwapar, two powers. They're really the powers of light and dark, or the upper death drive and the lower. But when we come to the winter of time, to the Kali Yuga, the lower death drive gains dominance and eventually snuffs out the last embers of the light. And the world, as a macro morphogenic field, becomes vibrationally attuned to the nihilistic intention and attitude and feeling. Tamasic vibrations, depressive, anxious, hopeless, and all at the same time angry and retaliatory, vengeful, envious, demanding, etc. But for the most part, the weakness of the ego and self-hatred underlies its power impulse, as well as its self-sabotaging impulse. Because of the self-hatred and the hatred of the other that caused it to feel the way it does, there's a hatred of the world and a subliminal, subconscious, although becoming ever more conscious, lower death drive demand for annihilation of a cold, cruel world in which there is no love. And why? Because no one is emanating that love or light any longer. They're in a state of taking, of contracting, of neediness, not of emanation, of joy, but of a fear of life, and that overwhelms the fear of death and makes death seem to be a respite from one's agony, one's suffering. And so because the ego is in such enslavement to the other, it cannot any longer take the upper death drive. It has received an irrevocable command not to grow, to remain the child psychologically, never to break through that rite of passage into adulthood that can take responsibility for the sustenance of the world, but only wants to consume and receive without earning. And so we have a capitalist system that has become monopolistic, governed by the most power-hungry and psychopathic to gain monopoly over all of the productive facilities and literally enslave the masses, but no longer even needing them or wanting them because of the exhaustion of Western civilization that has lost all of its creative power. All of the productive energies have gone into industries of destruction, of creating weapons of mass destruction and totalitarian control. And that death drive has resulted in the perpetration of mass murder disguised as a health industry trying to protect your life. And because the ego has so much fear of death as well as of life, it's willing to give in, and it cannot think clearly enough to see what is happening. And so there is a subconscious desire for death within every ego today. And the only hope of escaping the clutches of those self-sabotaging energies that will come out either somatically in terms of disease, illness, and mental disorders, the only way of escaping is the upper death drive through surrender of one's willpower, one's heart, one's mind to the source of consciousness. If you stay with the ego narrative, you'll find out that narrative is causing you to make very bad decisions that are producing situations of self and other defeat. It's the wanting both to be destroyed that is the intention of the ego. And therefore, all organizations are being sabotaged from within. They don't need external enemies. And that self-sabotage is responsible for the destruction of every social order and institution within a larger social order. So a yogi must become free of those tendencies. But the problem is the ego has been indoctrinated to basically believe it's worthless, and not even to believe that there is a God, let alone that one could be worthy of accessing such power that could free one from one's own mind. And that cynicism and that sense of alienation from the self has produced a veil that is opaque and prevents even the intention to consistently attempt to master the mind or surrender the mind to the master self. And the ego wants autonomy. It doesn't want to surrender to any authority, inner or outer, but it also has complete passivity and lostness and no will to move out of its internal paralysis, because there's too much conflict within the ego itself to make a change, to dare to become different from what it was and from the other that demands one to be at their service. And language itself is the internalization of that bondage. So if the narrative cannot be extinguished, it will hypnotize one to follow the orders of the other that have been imposed into the ego's core instructions that sustain the self-sabotaging habit patterns that bring an immediate jouissance, and then after that, suffering, disappointment, devastation, the realization of one's self-defeat. So this process, as it accelerates, and the energies of destruction become ever greater, there's a collective intention that must be manifested, that must explode into actuality of the expression of this destructiveness as the end of the world, through which the revelation that consciousness doesn't end with the end of life, doesn't end with the end of a supposed world, but in fact awakens one again to the eternal nature of consciousness. But if the sanskara of forgetfulness and of fall into identification has not been released, then there will only be a suspended animation of the expression of that sanskara until, again, one finds oneself on the wheel of life and death and doesn't know how you got there. But we brought ourselves to that point. And so we've said that the real functions with call and response, but when you hear the call of truth, of the real, however it can come directly from within, or it can come from recognizing truth that is being spoken or is being perceived in an event, or it can be simply an intuition that arises from within and enables a luminous clarity to take over, at least momentarily. But there is that that potency of receiving a call and responding to it. Now, the ego can't respond to the call, but the soul can take responsibility, right? The ability to respond cannot be lost by the soul once the soul realized that it has been called, not the ego, but the soul has been called to awaken from its slumber, which is a kind of a death, and to awaken to the responsibility to become a temple of that supreme intelligence and consciousness that can emanate the light again into the dream field. This is our responsibility, why we were created by the Creator that is our own consciousness, why we have appeared within the matrix of the dream field. But now we must reach that level of our being in which we can deliver the grace to that character that enables it to become a pure reflection and instrument of the Supreme Intelligence. And that can only happen through the soul's reunification with that oneself. So there's little time left to do it. There's a tiny sliver of an Indian summer, you could say, in the end of winter on the cycle of time. And maybe it's called that because we have to return to the philosophy of India, of the ancient time, in which that non-duality and the recognition of the self as the Surya, the sun. The word swastika also comes from that. It's the auspiciousness of the light of the sun going through the entire day and being in sync with the light and never falling into the darkness, never forgetting the power of the light that is guiding the entire process, even when it seems to be eclipsed by the dark forces. But one's veiling never becomes totally opaque. That power of perception of the real, it cannot be ever entirely lost. But there must be a will to remove the veil so that the sun, with its overwhelming power, washes away the ego complex and its sanskaras, its collapsed quality and wave functions, and then the power immediately emerges from potency to actuality. So, rather than ramble on any further, I think I'll open the floor to see if there is anyone with a particular question that I might be helpful in answering. If you're having some obstacle on the inner pilgrimage of remembrance of the self that gets interrupted by various forms of indentured servitude to the other. Let me ask this question to you then, since you don't have one at the moment. How many of you are aware that when you go on automatic pilot, you find yourself doing things that result in self and other defeat or sabotage? That's what's in the field, and that's what will motivate the ego when there isn't presence. The automaticity of that intention creates a kind of a whirlpool in which that karma gets enacted. And that becomes the focus of one's unfoldment, and it's being caught in the whirlpool of the lower death drive. And for some people, this is a very constant discovery. They've done it again. They've done it again. And the habit can't be stopped because there isn't enough awareness before it to make a different decision. The awareness comes after, and when it comes after, it doesn't come with the power of vimarsha, it doesn't come with the ability to rethink, it only comes with the ability to react with more guilt, more shame, more sense of hopelessness.
Thanks, Shunya. That idea or the concept of rethinking, I was trying to understand how that relates to the elimination of language or the silencing of language. It seems like that's the step that's necessary in order to stop the automatic narratives that are happening so that the rethinking can actually come from a different level of mind.
Yeah, it must come from a different level. And in a way, that's the point of being startled, that you realize that the level you were thinking was inadequate. It was concealing truths that were implicit in the situation or event or the moment, and that you weren't able to penetrate deeply enough into to perceive what was you were really called to do or to recognize in that moment. Like Parsifal, who wasn't able to speak, right? What ails you, king, you know? And wasn't able to fulfill his knightly function because of a very fixed identification with a certain convention about not speaking, but that didn't allow him to connect with his heart. So yes, the rethinking is the realization that there has to be another way, a paradigm shift, an entirely new way of looking at what you took for granted was only that and turns out to be this, or has meaning moreness. And so it requires a very sound kind of re-reasoning about your situation to bring yourself to another context, another paradigm, another way of perceiving reality from a higher chakra or a higher assemblage point, and to be able to sustain that enough to receive higher symbolic thought, not the lower thought that's imaginarized and pertains only to the character, but symbolic thought, archetypal thought, is pointing to the real beyond the character. It's pointing to the universal, not the particular, and it's pointing to that divine intelligence that is able to become completely free from any of the bondages of the thinking character, who is actually the product of the thought of the other. And all the thoughts you have as an ego aren't really your thoughts. They might be reactions to the thought of the other, but the reaction is going to contain bondage to the other and to the past and to that which is unreal and unable to grow to the point of a symbolic capacity to transcend the ego. So there has to be that rethinking that then brings you beyond thought itself, to the source of thought, the intelligence itself, that doesn't need to think because you already know. The knowledge is there and it unfolds spontaneously.
Beautiful, thank you. I feel like the example you gave us of rethinking that phrase that you were mentioning that you wrote as the thumbnail, it was like, mm-hmm. it wasn't thought-provoking enough, but it provoked a great deal of thought about what that meant that allowed you to share with us a great deal of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So I felt like a real beautiful example of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was downloaded into the mind, so it came from a surrender to a situation in which there was no longer a known, but an unknowing, and it's the need to be in that realization that I know nothing, and that emptiness of belief that enables new ideas of a higher capacity to become not only thought, but developed and transformed into philosophy, science, art, into whatever. But all of those higher thoughts are intended to be used for creativity, for emanation of the powers of consciousness. Whereas the thought of the ego is always contraction and fear and defensiveness and I shoulda, coulda, woulda, and all of that, but there's no openness and no yes and no complete freedom to spontaneously allow the power of the self to move you.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Thank you for your question. It's a very important one.
Question from Judy. I feel stuck being able to touch a feeling of abject error from my birth trauma, coupled with a constant headache in my crown chakra and around the back of my skull. I go into the terror and try to bring light, but cannot so far move in deep and accomplish this. Can you assist me with this?
Traumas that happen before the acquisition of language remain in a somatized bind like the one you just described. And there is no way to break into it except, first of all, through giving it your full attention and compassion and acceptance and love. And it's not always easy to give love to pain. But when you realize that the pain is a cry for help, and within that cry, there is a tremendous amount of information that you haven't allowed yourself to receive because you felt it would bring you a more unbearable pain to know why the somatic pain is there, and the fear of mentalization of it causes there to be a conflict about whether to translate it into imagery, memories, understanding, and a mature capacity to grasp its true place within your psychic economy. And the only way you'll be able to do that is to recognize that you are not the one having pain. You are the soul who is aware that the body has pain. And do not take it as your own pain. It is the pain of the animal organism that you are riding on and using in this life to express your consciousness. And it is containing aspects of your consciousness that you have refused to fully accept and to bring out from a repressed and somatized state. So you have to be willing to free the information, because if you don't, you remain in bondage to that pain and the ignorance that the pain is, because it hasn't been translated into language and symbolic terms. Because only once you have done that will you be able to rethink the situation and realize that the trauma is a traum, a dream, and that that dream is there to awaken you to your real function in the world that your ego cannot know. And so the pain is a great blessing once you have been able to juice it and to recognize that within every trauma is the nectar of immortal bliss. But it must be freed from its sense of not being wanted, and therefore of contracting it and disappearing it into the body as a kind of a black hole of dread and of self-hatred. So it has to be returned to its true nature as wisdom and love, and then it becomes beauty and it becomes power to heal yourself, but also to use the wisdom from that healing to heal others who suffer from the same a kind of pain, and to give them the ability to become free.
Yes, so I have a couple questions, and it's sort of related to the answer that you were just giving. But I was wondering, like, where does anger come into play in the self and other destruction? And sort of like, what is a person, or specifically me, like what is someone angry about, like originally? And then, like, does an infant experience anger, or is that like a sedimentary thing where it kind of becomes anger later, but it's maybe a different experience at a young age or something?
No, infants can experience anger, definitely, and also despair, you see, anger is often a defense against falling into despair. And the despair is, mommy doesn't love me. She's not here. I'm crying. I'm calling out. She doesn't come. I must be worthless in her eyes. She has something better to do, right? And then the feeling of, okay, I'm going to die. And even the desire to die to get away from whatever the pain or discomfort one is in, and the fear of loneliness and abandonment, the lower death drive captures one. And the only way to escape that suicidal pull is to turn it into anger, aggressivity against the other, and blame. And at least that keeps one alive because of the will to vengeance, the ressentiment, as Nietzsche called it, the resentment toward the cruel world that produces a kind of a nihilistic projection on the generalized other later in life in a preconception that the other is going to fail one and abandon one and betray one, and therefore will provoke all of that through a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the anger has the almost immediate karmic blowback of others getting angry at you. And so then there's conflict, and the world becomes a fight club. And there's a need to have such fighting going on because it's the only time one feels really alive is when one is fighting for one's life, because otherwise the death drive pulls one down. And so aggressivity becomes the fuel of a despairing ego.
So even like an infant will use anger to not fall into the lower death drive?
Yeah, you've never heard an infant screaming?
I guess, yeah. It just doesn't really make sense conceptually to picture like an angry...
Oh, sure. They'll pout and sulk and wet their bed, and they'll do all kinds of things, passive and active aggression to make the point known. And they'll bite the mother's nipple, and they'll do whatever. They will use their aggressivity in a way that will try to get the attention of the mother to. And they can get sick also, because then you finally will get more, you know, pity and attention when the baby is sick, and that often becomes then a habit and a strategy for keeping the other enslaved to the needs of one's own inability to function. So these habit patterns start very early in life, and also the infant imitates and sees how others are also doing that, and then it becomes part of their repertoire very quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question from Ute. As you explained, my constant struggle is to give up because of my physical inability and or will to stay in the light that came with the realization I had. You also explained that the connection to God, the self, is lost or inaccessible due to the upbringing and experiences that I had. How can I free the connection to God?
Well, first of all, you now know that you are not the body and you are not the ego. You are pure awareness. So the first thing there is to do is disidentify from the body and its operating system, which right now are probably nearly all your thoughts. So only when you get that distance and recognize that you are presence will you then be able to receive a higher level not only of understanding and acceptance of the karma and recognition that it's actually a blessing, and it enables you to focus totally on the internal and transcendent dimension of your being, because it can't express itself so freely on the physical plane, and maximize the freedom that is possible for your consciousness. So there has to be a letting go of all of the reactive attitudes, whether it's of self-pity or of a sense of hopelessness or dread or anger at the other for bringing you into that situation, or anger at God, through acceptance begin to appreciate the gift that consciousness itself is, and that you haven't yet opened. It's like a gift that you've never unwrapped, and you have to open it up and go deeply into it, and you will discover powers of your being that you did not know you had, that will enable you to function out of body and out of the ordinary levels of the phenomenal plane, and experience in the angelic light the potency of your consciousness to act with great effectiveness in the world as a server of God at the level of that transcendent supernal luminosity and intelligence that is not accessible to the ego, but is to the awakened soul that is attracted again through love to the source of consciousness and of being. And through that, it will no longer matter how your body condition is. You will no longer even feel it. You'll be so in the light and the joy of the power of your real presence that an entirely different level of consciousness will cause the one you're at now to completely disappear and be replaced by an entirely different manifestation of the dream field from that place of higher intelligence. You're good.
Thank you, Shinya. Thank you for this teaching. I feel everything is happening all at the same time, so there's a soul that feels this concept of taking responsibility and responding and opening and loving and being a servant, but that there's a continuous self-sabotage and other sabotage that comes back to this, what you were saying, this command not to grow, to stay stunted. Mm-hmm. And there's this continuous and just ridiculous fight between the ego and the superego. And so, but my question is about what happened, like, when it's calm, there's a capacity to be in meditation, to be open, there's a capacity to pray, to reach out. But in the really dark night, it just feels there's a sort of a wretched ego begging the superego to let it go. It's like, God, please help me. But I know that there's this superego that just sits atop this mm-hmm. consciousness and just stops everything from, mm-hmm. and is just this tyrannical blob mm-hmm. that won't let the prayers reach. And it's just begging a bully to stop rather than to God to release and to surrender.
Mm-hmm. You described it very poignantly and very accurately, and it's almost universal today, so don't take it personally that you're in this situation of bondage to the other, which is right. The superego.
Right.
But you're only in bondage to it so long as you believe in what it is commanding you and in its legitimacy of authority. you know, and you know it doesn't have that because you project it out on the other and then sabotage them as being illegitimate, right? And rebelling against them. But you can't rebel against your own superego because you are afraid of losing the identity of the lost boy in Neverland and then having to become responsible, right? So the command not to grow is also accompanied by an antagonism to growth and responsibility for the other, because that original other you don't want to be responsible for, even though you're responsible to its commands. So the only way out is to reach an awareness of both, of the realization of this dyad that is going on, and that you are neither the child nor the tyrannical parent, and they are both parts of a fictional narrative that you are holding on to in your mind. Neither of them really exist except in your imagination, right? And when you disinvest your desire from wanting vengeance against the other and conquest and to prove she was wrong, I was right, and to get what you couldn't get, when you have let go of that desire, then the whole thing dissolves, because it's only kept alive because you're breathing your own desire into it to continue that narrative and feeding off of the agony and the occasional ecstasy of an illusion of power and conquest over the other externalized in the world that never holds and brings you into karmic blowback. So once you understand all of that, you have to sustain the intelligent awareness that you're neither of these characters, and you don't want to project them out onto the world. You want to withdraw all of that energy back into the source and realize you are unborn consciousness without any predispositions. And there is neither an internal other nor an internal infantile ego that is having tantrums and whatever, and that both of these are simply obsolete stories that you've been holding on to because you didn't have a better story to replace it with. But now you do. You have the ability to write a new script for yourself, or even to live omprav, like without a script, and to be free to become continually different from what you were and from what the other is, and stop being an imitation of yourself and of the other, but become original. And that originality will give even more power to deconstruct all of these sanskaras, but to use the wisdom of your having accomplished that to be able to help others accomplish that. And that will bring great satisfaction and gratitude and fulfillment. So realize this is the raw material, the negredo, and now your alchemical process has to transform it into the philosopher's stone, the diamond mind. But you have that ability, okay?
Thank you.
It's a struggle, it's a battle, but there should be a joy in being a warrior, right? And earning your freedom from self-inflicted bondage. I didn't mean to interrupt, go ahead.
No, I thank you. I think that knowing all this to be absolutely true, why am I still holding on to this ridiculous false narrative? What
you are not holding on. Your character is holding on because it can't do anything else. It's a robot. It's an NPC. But you're not your character. That's what you have to realize. And it's only through the disidentification from it that you have the power to dissolve it, right? But you have to want to eliminate it from your mind, and be willing to be alone in the space of solitude and silence that is pure consciousness. And then you will realize who you really are. But you have to know you're not that and be in emptiness long enough to receive the fullness of the real.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, it's important to be humble and honest and open to confront these issues and to speak about them, because every time that you do that, you shift your relationship to the story. And eventually you become alienated from the story and more resonant with the power of bringing about a miraculous shift in the script through your own coming to presence in the now. Okay?
Haji.
All right. Thank you. You're good. Go ahead, Purusha, while she's walking up.
Another question from Ute. Is pain in the lower back always connected to some sexual trauma, as I recall you mentioning?
Not always, no. I wouldn't want to make an overgeneralization. It's often that, but it can also be an inversion of your power, a kind of a contraction and a collapse of your power, the dantian, as the Taoists call that area, and a sense of deflation and of a lack of fortitude to be able to persevere through a blockage that is really between chakra one and the higher chakras, and it keeps one in the lower death drive and in a state of feeling helpless and passive and unable to act. So the more that one does, I won't call it a performativity paradox, let's call it the presencing paradox. The more that you become present to the situation without identifying with it, the more your presence will lift the kundalini from that first chakra where there's a glitch and a cut of the sushumna, and enable the power of the pranic force of growth and life and love to bring you to realize and connect with the higher shakti that's coming from the source. And then once the current of energy is flowing, that glitch, at least at a let's call it a pranic level, can be healed. The body may not necessarily at an organic level be, but the prana will, and there will be an entirely different vibrational frequency that fills the body. Okay. Nectar drop.
Thank you. So fear comes up lately in these circumstances of not wanting to create more karma, going on these autopilot, feeling that I have no control, or that it's how to break that cycle of the fear of causing not wanting to cause more karma, but the fear that I feel kind of paralyzed in the sense of like that something may come, and how to decrease that fear and not have the fear. Where is the fear coming from? Because I feel like it's like paralyzing to the extent of not knowing what decision to make, if I should do this or that, or and it becomes then it creates, I feel, more karma. So how to get out of that cycle?
Yeah, well, first of all, that self-doubt and fear is embedded at the core of the ego because it relates to a trauma very early in life, and the ego grew around it. So it has always been there. It's not, you know, just now. It'll apply itself to even the fear of the fear, but it's still the same complex operating because paranoia is its modus operandi. And so you have to become present to it without identifying with it. You won't just eliminate it, but you have to realize you are conscious of the fear, and that consciousness itself cannot be the fear. Mm-hmm. And there are moments when the fear is not there, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if the fear is sometimes not there, but the consciousness is there, the consciousness is what you are. The fear is an appearance, and every appearance is a projection. It won't appear unless you have given it permission to appear, unless you have a predisposition to feel fear. There's an enjoyment of fear. You have to get to the jouissance that fear gives you, because fear has a secondary gain that you may try to attract a rescuer to save you from that fear. And then you are not alone, because part of the fear is being abandoned and unwanted and rejected, and the fear of being found worthless by the other, right? So that's why there's doubt. What should I do? Because how will the other react? I don't know. And so the ego is always going through this narrative of bewilderment on how to satisfy the other, and it doesn't know. And the only way out is to realize that you are not that set of habitual fear-creating sanskaras, but you are awareness in which you can make the choice not to project that into your character any longer. But you can only do it from the soul level. You can't do it from the ego itself. Mm-hmm. But the soul can say, and feel such a level of peace that it can soothe that fear with love and with a connection to God that gives you a sense of security, mm-hmm. right? And so that sense of connection, whether you want to call it God or you want to call it just the ultimate presence that is your consciousness itself, will be able to soothe the fear and give a state and a sense of security again. And then once that is no longer a habit you identify with, it will gradually disappear entirely.
Great, thank you. That was very soothing. Hmm? It was soothing.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. Now keep soothing yourself.
Okay, from Bryant. What is the best way to keep the mind as much in the light as possible while going about one's daily and seemingly necessary tasks of living? It can be quite difficult to not get caught up in the minutia of it all.
There is a training period that is required to make the effort to remember and recognize that you are awareness, you are presence, you are not the thinking apparatus. And that presence is not the character that appears and acts in the world. The world is a movie, and you have to be aware that you are watching it, you're not in it. And only when you realize that will you recognize that it is within you, but it is within you as a character of your own imagination, not an artifact of the other's demands and commands, but your own imagination. And you have the power and the responsibility to free your character from its bondages to the other, to the world, to its attitudes and orientations and beliefs. and to regain that freedom that is pure presence. So the more that you practice remaining present while active, become present in a sitting meditation, but then reach a point where there's no difference between meditating and being active. And then the whole, all of life becomes a meditation. And you never leave presence. And you reach a point where the real interest, the real focus becomes the light that is pouring through the character and directing its actions in accord with the will of God. And that's what produces the fulfillment that enables the complete letting go of any investment in the character or its world, and the investment again in the eternal presence that is forever transcendent of bodies and of time and space. So the more that you practice, the more that you'll establish yourself in that Atmanishta, as it's called, in which you never leave the light of pure awareness. Okay. Oh, there's one more? Okay. You can...
There's one more.
Go ahead.
Okay, from Jan. To be in emptiness and increase the chance for receiving wonder, is it wise to explore where one least wants to look? Or is it better...
Wise to explore what?
Where one least wants to look.
Ah.
Or is it better to focus on something one has a deep interest in, but doesn't understand that area?
I don't think either one of those. I think you want to simply focus on who is the I that would ask a question like that. Right? Because the ego always wants to create doubt, a conflict. Should I do this or should I do that? But awareness doesn't act. It doesn't do anything. It's pure being. And the more that you are in the state of pure being, then the power of intelligence of that pure being will move the character spontaneously. And you won't be the wanderer or even the wonderer of what I should do, but you will be the wondrous power of creativity that acts through the character, but without identification. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Shunya. Could humor be one of the tools, aware and conscious humor, one of the tools to help release consciousness out of ego tendencies and just get us in that observer mode, or is it something that causes avoidance of the awareness?
Well, it depends on the type of humor, because there is sarcastic humor and savage humor and ironic humor that is has a cynical tinge to it, right? And there is the God sense of humor, which just sees both the absurdity of the phenomenal plane, but the wisdom that's contained within it, and the beauty of the tragicomedy of the phenomenal existence at the end of Kali Yuga, but is able to choose the comic side of that and then recognize the blessing that comes from realizing the perfection of being able to redirect that character's functioning toward becoming an instrument of God's humor and God's love and joy that is expressed through the character. So it's no longer your humor as an individual, because your sense of humor may or may not be in resonance with that of God. But when you get out of the way, you will see all of this is humorous But humor in the sense of bringing joy and beauty and hidden blessings to the world, and that there is never anything to be sad about or angry or upset about in any way. And that good humor of a sense of total well-being will emanate from you and bring others into a state of good humor as well. But it has to be at that level of such resonance with that supreme intelligence and the humor that comes from that source in perceiving the non-duality of being and becoming that enables everything to be recognized as perfect.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, if there's no other questions, this would be the moment then to adjourn. I hope this has been helpful to people and that it clarifies both the process and the urgency of completing that process, because we are now in a situation where time within the phenomenal circuit is very short before the life energies of the planet itself are exhausted and destroyed by the collective death drive. So we want to have transcended that level of our consciousness before that happens, so we can serve at the angelic level and help bring souls to the light and out of the darkness of their own egoic bondage. So we must all become liberators. And to do that, we must have liberated ourselves first. So that has to be the responsibility that we fulfill as manifestations of God. Namaste.
Namaste.